This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is December 14th, 1994, and I'm continuing with the second interview with Carl Kasel on his years here at the University of Wisconsin. We're going to start today by talking a little bit about your teaching and research interests and your career here at the UW. What courses have you been primarily responsible for as a teacher?
When I came in, the Department of Educational Policy Studies was teaching little modules, one credit thing. So my very first teaching experience at University of Wisconsin was courses that actually bit the dust and didn't continue after about 4 or 5 years later. So I did a little module on the Reconstructionist educators and Dewey and Counts and what happened in the 1930s, and just 5 weeks on that one topic. And I did one on Washington versus Du Bois and the aftermath of that debate about vocationalism in black education. And that was in 1970, so these issues were pretty hot. A young white male coming in from Harvard teaching African American history, black history. So I had some people kind of checking me out on that. The atmosphere was quite political. Yeah. I've forgotten what the third module was. But soon, the spring of my first year, I taught the big lecture course in the history of American education. It was then called History EPS 628. And as I said at my farewell party the other day, lo and behold, the Chicago History Department labeled my first course, picking numbers out of a hat, History 628, the first course I'm going to teach in Chicago. So these are the little continuities in my life. So that had a TA and, 70 or 80 students and so forth. It was a way for me to get used to the big scale of teaching here. And that's where I first devised my lectures. And I used to drive in from Middleton, where I lived, only 3 hours ahead of the students. That is, I was writing a lecture for 11 o'clock that morning, get up at 5 and stop at Henry's restaurant, Henry's Little Greasy Spoon restaurant, which is now the Bon Thai. I'm the only person in town that knows that. And I would have my bacon and eggs and roaring into my office and try and do my lectures. What else did I teach? Stan Katz had welcomed me to the Colonial History staff, so I taught these first-year graduate student courses in the History Department called History 901 on different topics. It's a repeatable course, and they offer 6 or 7 of them every semester. So I taught that on colonial history because I had studied with Balin at Harvard, and Stan, I guess, felt he could use the help. So that was a good welcome into the History Department and a way to get to meet the first-year graduate students in history. There were a variety of other things. We team taught, both in a faculty group of 5 at one point, the course called School and Society.
Oh,
so that was my introduction to foundations.
Yeah, how did that work?
It was a big reform. Well, the big thing we put the most effort into didn't work at all. We thought the students would find it amusing and entertaining and energizing to have 4 or 5 professors from different disciplines who would disagree on different policy issues, and you'd find out how an anthropologist thought and how a sociologist thought. I think the students wanted their money back because they felt if we couldn't figure out what the answers were, why should they sit around and listen to us argue about them? So it didn't work. I've heard about courses like that before where you just introduce so much static into it and there were so many things going on in the course that it didn't work at all. But in the aftermath of that, I team taught it with one other person several times, and that kind of synergy, I think, worked. I team taught that course with Mike Olnick, the sociologist, and with Francis Schrag, the philosopher. And I like that. I don't know what happened to that idea. It's always, some work collaborating. And eventually we went back to teaching our regular sections of that. Over the years, it developed that I taught mainly 4 things. And as far back as 10 or 12 years ago, I pretty much taught them. The teaching schedule needed them. So there wasn't a lot of room for me to experiment. At one point, I did teach other courses. I taught the undergraduate social history course once, but my 4 standard stock and trade was the graduate seminar, the graduate pro seminar, what we call a pro seminar, which is a reading seminar of a book a week called 906, cross-listed in history and educational policy studies on the literature on the history of my field, the history of American education. The 901, which eventually I would offer it not in colonial history, but in 19th century history, but that was a history course not listed in educational policy studies and not particularly about education. The most recent incarnation of that is the course that I just finished today. I guess that's my last course at the University of Wisconsin. The last class of my last course. It was a lovely group of people. It was like some deity of universities was up there giving me just this dandy group of people that talked well and smart and liked each other, and it was balanced participation and all this stuff. The seminar just taught itself. So I finished that today. That was on American social and cultural history from, I think I defined it as 1860 to 1940. So there was the graduate level course in the history of American education, the graduate level course in social history in the history department, school and society, which is our basic meat and potatoes course in educational policy studies, sometimes taught in large lecture format, but most often taught in one professor, 35 students format, and I enjoyed that a lot. And the lecture on the history of American education, which has gone from being a course that enrolled, when I came here, enrolled 75 people and was taught every semester, then went down to enrolling smaller numbers and was only taught every other semester, to where we have it now. It satisfies a number of state requirements. That's one reason. I doubt it's because of the prowess of the faculty involved, because the students who take it don't know our department that well. But in any case, it now enrolls 180 people every semester. Yeah, every semester. Yeah. And it does so, I don't think it's the instructors, because it does so, it fills up and is oversubscribed all the time, whether Jürgen Herbst was teaching it or I was teaching it, or now Michael Foltz teaches it regularly. So I think it's because there are a lot of state requirements for teachers, and a lot of them take it. But we have a large number of students in that course from journalism, because it's gotten to be recommended as a course that journalism, future journalists should take. And it just has worked
future
its way.
Future journalists, that's interesting.
A lot of journalism students. And a variety of other people from around the campus. It's just worked its way into the recommended list of a lot of different departments and programs. So that is talk about a meat and potatoes course. That's a big one.
That's
it generates a lot of credits, and it is,
for
better or for worse, it's large lecture format. It's 2 50-minute lectures and a section. But I've sometimes tried to get the graduate students in that course, and there are a smattering of them, into my discussion section. Sometimes I've taken an undergraduate section. And that's the only way to make that class tolerable. I've had wonderful TAs, really a string of really creative, good teachers, a lot of them with a lot of high school teaching experience, so that they know there is such a thing as pedagogy. Mm-hmm. So they know you have to work at it, and that sections are not just something that happen, that you ask questions and the students, bushy-tailed and bright-eyed and having done the reading, answer them. So I've had a lot of good stuff go on in the sections of that. I still wonder whether it's the best form of undergraduate education, 180 people in a room listening to somebody tell them about stuff. But I worked hard at it, and I liked it.
When I taught school and society, you mentioned school and society, and I thought of something I haven't probably thought of in 10 years. I remember we were just starting human relations code points, which I believe was developed by Max Goodson, who was a colleague of yours in your first years in EPS. And then I stopped teaching, and I went on to other things. Did those code points stick around?
Yeah, they're alive and well. There are 8 of them now instead of 6. I don't pay a huge amount of attention to them because they've been in place for so long. And the two that we typically opt for in educational policy studies are the most academic of them. That is, we teach the code, the human relations code, that says students will learn about the forces of prejudice, group differences, and that kind of thing. And then the flip side of that is another one, that the positive side of that is to teach students about the positive contributions to education of different groups and leaders from different groups. That's pretty easy to do. The much more complicated code now is the state's whole elaborate code for teacher training that goes way beyond the human relations. It's about the whole substantive content of the teacher training program. So whereas they used to say, take a course in school and society, they no longer say, take a course in, they say, take courses that meet the following codes. So we not only have the human relations codes that we have to hang on these education courses, we have the state's DPI state code for teacher preparation. And school and society offers about 3 of those things. They're about teach the students about the professional organizations and the state structure in their state for the administration of schools and a whole bunch of very specific things. The reason we put up with that, even though people grouse about academic freedom, is it's a sort of a policy choice about how you do teacher training and state certification. In Wisconsin, the state says We won't have a state exam for teachers. We won't do that because people have persuaded us it's Mickey Mouse or it's not our tradition or whatever. We'll allow you to get automatic certification by graduating from a certification program within the state university or private college. But those programs will have to submit their programs to us, and they'll have to do the kind of key elements we think should be in teacher training. Well, if you make that kind of a bargain, the state has the right to prescribe some of the stuff you're doing. And you can't say, sorry, academic freedom, because they can say, well, that's fine. You can teach whatever you wish at the university, but we don't necessarily have to give certification to your students. So there's a lot prescribed, a lot more than many education professors would like to see prescribed for students in the teacher training code. A lot of it's good. A lot of this, and a lot of it pushed me to learn new material. This pains me to say it, but the state codes that made me teach about new minorities, having known a great deal about African American history and educational policy when I came here, I knew a lot about desegregation cases and so forth. I knew relatively little about Chicanos, and on into more newer groups that have asserted their rights and become part of the affirmative action world. So I've learned a lot more about Native Americans and Asians and their relationship to American public schools, partly to teach it in school and society.
Well, you've sort of started to answer my next question, so let me jump right into it. How, in terms of your teaching, how have you as a teacher, and how have your courses changed over the years, essentially?
There are a lot of different little ways they have. The course that's probably my main course, the large lecture course on the history of American education, used to be a little bit of everything, because I thought, well, you can't have a course in the history of American education without starting with the colonial period. And I would say, well, you can't have a course in the history of American education and not do higher education. Little by little, I've sacrificed some of the coverage to make it a more intense and more analytical experience. So I now do only half of the semester as a sort of a general overview. And then I think partly because of the liberal agenda of the 60s and these requirements that we teach about different groups who've been discriminated against in our society, but partly because I developed myself as a social historian. Social historians are always interested in the impact of institutions and the clients of institutions, and not just the leadership and the kind of conceptualization and the intentions of the institutions. So I now teach the course in two halves. One is an overview summary of how public schools came to be, almost exclusively devoted to elementary and secondary education. And then the whole second half looks at the experiences of women, on the one hand, African Americans and other racial minorities in the second case, and in the third case, American religious groups, including American Roman Catholics, American Amish, and so forth, who have raised particular issues. And I think that's the way you get at some of the texture of the school experience of more people than to just look at a history of the system. Because when you do the history of the system, there's a tendency to think of the clients as middle class and white and, you know, kind of suburban mainstream. So that's one big way in which my lecture course has changed. And it's changed, as I say, partly because of forces from without that said, if you're going to have this be part of the teacher training program, you have to teach certain things. And secondly, it's changed because I just was more and more self-conscious about my interest being as a social historian. I don't know that the course that you took, I think 906, has changed all that much. We try to read the best recent stuff. Sometimes we group it under little themes and sometimes we don't. But those courses are so lovely because they're as close as we come to the German ideal of the professor and the students being at the same level. I mean, the students may be beginning, but they're at the same conceptual level and the same level of being able to deal with the stuff. So those are not effortless for the instructor. They're kind of nerve-wracking because you want them to succeed so well, and they're such a sort of a precious experience. But they are a joyride in a way, because you're saying this is a group of scholars in this field. They're committed and they're smart and they're experienced. So those are fun. School and society, I think I know a lot more about educational policy now than I did when I came here. When I came here, I was trained as a historian and interested in education. And someone said, you know, it's always ironic we give our beginners our introductory courses because they're much harder to teach than our advanced courses. Advanced courses is what graduate students are especially trained to do. You know, how about giving a course in your dissertation? So I think it's really true, and I do think that senior people can do introductory courses better if they're in the kind of synthesis area like teach a course on school and society. Now, people have treated this school and society, of course, different ways. For the people who say, well, it's a romp from Plato to John Dewey, mm-hmm. that doesn't change from year to year. But to the extent that you're trying to teach about policy issues, which I think is true to the name of our department, then it changes every year, the readings change, and it's a huge amount of work, and you just wind up having more stock in trade. You know, since it's interdisciplinary, you know what the better stuff is to read in somebody else's discipline, like sociology of education. You can find someone who can help summarize for you what the real truth is about this inequality business in Christopher Jenks, which you don't really know anything about. And I've had junior people tell me that that's one of the problems in putting together a policy course as a young person, is that they don't have the stock of in trade, especially the kind of quick ways to find out the wisdom of another field that you just keep, you know, filing away as a senior person and keep in touch with different faculty members. So the 300 course, even though it's the lowest level course I do, it's the entry level course for juniors who are education majors, has been the one that's been the closest in relationship to my policy interests. That's where I teach about desegregation, that's where I teach about ethnicity and, I mean, a whole bunch of other things, religion, church and mm-hmm. state cases and so forth. And so that has had a kind of a funny symbiotic relationship between my research interests and my teaching interests. That's the way I look on my teaching now. And then when I became a violist professor and they said, the idea is you'll teach half as much, I just took those four courses and spread them out over a 2-year cycle. And I think ever since then, I guess I've been a violist professor for 5 years, I've just done those four courses.
Well, that's,
you know,
nice.
In rotation, two courses each year. And I have not tried to teach any specialized courses. I mean, I'm interested in the history of literacy and things like that, but I thought, since I have this privileged position and I don't get into the teaching, you know, lineup as often, I should teach the courses that are most needed. So that's what I've been doing.
I want to get into your research interests in a moment, but let me ask one thing about the students you've had over the years. I don't think we want to get into necessarily particular students, but if you can do this generally, I don't know if it can be done, I'd like to ask you a question similar to your teaching question. In what ways, if at all, have students at the graduate level and or the undergraduate level changed in your years here at UW? And that can be in terms of the type of student, the interests, et cetera.
Well, I know historians are interested in change, and that the oral history archives should be in the service of that, you know, doing history at the university. But I my reaction to your question is it's remarkable for how little they've changed.
Oh, well, that's
And I suppose that's worth saying.
I
don't know that in EPS we've torn our hair and complained and said that the students were getting worse all the time. I've never heard that up there, but you used to hear it in the history department. It's just not true.
I hear that all over.
It's not true. I guess you heard it for a while about literacy, nobody can write anymore.
Mm-hmm.
As John Palmer would be a better source on this than me, but we have been in a very unusual situation in the Ed School. Let's do that first before we think about history. But in the School of Education, at the very time everybody was saying literacy was declining and all, and now that women had better opportunities, they were going into other professional schools, mm-hmm. and we had, you know, kind of sexism had actually brought more talent into the elementary and secondary school classrooms, which is true. Mm-hmm. Nationally, scores went down. But not at the University of Wisconsin. It's been odd. I don't know exactly why. It may be that more kids around the state saw more benefit to going to Madison, and so talented kids that might have otherwise gone to the branches around the state. You could ask John why this happened. But we have been in a position, as you may know, where the education major's gotten more and more competitive, the writing skills, mm-hmm. and it shows up in the classroom. The idea that the kids have to have a higher GPA to get into Ed School now than they did 10 years ago is not just on paper or some abstraction. The kids can write better and think better. So we've had this odd situation while everybody else has been complaining. Our students have been getting better. So that's not exactly the same. That's change for
that's
the better over
positive
time.
Change,
yeah,
which is really different
change.
From what I've been
gathering
from other people.
I have a lot of fun telling colleagues around the country. I mean, a lot of the people I interact with are in Ed Schools, but whether they are or not, everyone knows that Ed Schools are supposed to be the bottom of the heap, and even Al Shanker is out there telling everybody that education majors are from the bottom quarter of the college population and everything. And I say, well, it's really hard to get into education at Wisconsin. If you can't be a social studies teacher, I hear my students say, you'll have to be just a history major.
Hmm.
And if you can't get into journalism, you might have to be just an English major.
Isn't that interesting?
And the reason is that the professional schools are allowed to have entry GPAs, and the college is not.
if you can get into UW-Madison, they can't prohibit you from taking a major. Because if they did, everybody would try and be the hotshots with only the most academically talented kids. But the Ed School, I don't know about the journalism school, but the Ed School was under terrific public pressure because it's a policy issue. We want to have the best people teaching in our classrooms. So when all this 1980s reforms came around, they jacked up the GPA. And happily, at Madison, there was an ample supply of such people to get into the teacher training programs. So it's a very odd thing, and it's been a very happy circumstance, because even my colleagues who would like to believe in this kind of conservative view that the world is falling apart and everything's getting to be flabby standards and everything, they say in their own classrooms it's not true. Hmm. Education majors here are better than ever. At the graduate level, I think things have been more or less the same as far as I can tell. My own doctoral students have been few enough in number, so it isn't really possible to talk about trends, I don't think.
What about minority students and women? And is there more of a diverse portrait of the graduate student in EPS today than there was back
No, in the 70s? I don't think so. One of the things that brought a whole pile of minority students, two things that brought minority students in EPS happened rather early when I was here. So in a context of a campus that doesn't do terribly well on minorities despite all our best intentions and efforts, and even despite the big push on it under Shalala, I would say the thing that brought a lot of minorities into EPS was Vern Halbrick's Urban Change Agents program, and Hazel Simonette and some other African Americans, and I'm not sure if there are any Chicanos, but then Richard Ruiz had some training money to do PhDs for Chicanos. And it was at those times that I came into contact with those students, some of whom wound up being my students. Mario Compion, who is very active in the Chicano Studies program here, is my current doctoral student, as is Steve Casanova, another Chicano. But these have happened not because of a shift over time, but because somebody made some kind of a programmatic effort to get training money that was related to minorities. The Department of Educational Policy Studies now has, as you know, two assistant professors who are people of color, one Chinese American and one African American. And I think that that's part of what it takes to develop a kind of a regular and continued coterie of graduate students. I think it does take those role models.
Can it be done in Madison? Can it be done in Madison, do you think?
I don't know. I will have my fingers crossed as I leave this place, because it's just so much harder to do it in Madison, Wisconsin, than it is in
Chicago,
the Southwest, or even in Chicago, where the minority population is there.
I'll be interested in talking to you after 10 years at Chicago and see
if there are very many minorities at Chicago, it's probably just because it's the natural environment of the place, and there are smart minorities who want to go to the University of Chicago. What I mean is, it's not by virtue of any special efforts or policies on the part of Chicago. I'm sure there are people in the administration that try to recruit minorities because that's a national phenomenon. But Chicago is much less into that agenda. Mm-hmm. I already know that before I go there than Wisconsin is. So I think it's our environment and the state's history, and we've run into it in trying to attract minority professors. Some are very willing to come here, but whether they're willing to come here or edgy about coming here, there's always a recognition that the culture will be very different from what they've left behind, whether they're urban African American or especially in the case where they're Chicano. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a continuing battle, and I don't know if it was in this conversation yesterday that we taped or not, but I thought that the key to this is almost a magical thing that's almost impossible. It's to get from 2% quickly to 10%.
Oh, yes, we did talk about that.
If you only go from 2 to 4, yeah, it doesn't seem to change the environment. Yeah. And I don't know what's going to happen in the coming 10 years, but I'll repeat what I said yesterday. I would agree with the Shalalas of the world and Calvin Trillin, who said about Yale that if the demography of this place doesn't change, it won't be a great institution 20 years from now. How much it has to change, I don't know, but we need more diverse people on the faculty, and we're doing, I think, somewhat better with women faculty members than we are with minority faculty members. So the history department is much better on gender scores. Now, that's not a complacent statement. I haven't counted recently, but the nice thing about the history department is you can't count on one hand how many women there are in the department, and the exact number doesn't matter anymore because they've become people. Mm-hmm. And so you say, we have a terrific person in Chilean history. Her name is Florencia Mallon. Mm-hmm. You don't say, studies Chile. And I was here when the first woman in the history of the department was appointed. Diane Lindstrom came after I came. And she was for some years the only woman in the department. forced to teach women's history, even though it wasn't her field and not something she was particularly interested in doing. So we've come a great long ways, and I think there are probably something in the line of a dozen to 15 women in the department of 52 or 3 now, so something like that. Maybe closer to a dozen than 15. I tried to name them the other day, and I happily found out that I couldn't. Couldn't name them all. So that's better, but students are not much more diverse in terms of race than they were. Excluding foreigners, I think we're not doing terribly well on Chicano and African-American students. I happen to have a bunch in my seminar this year, and if I thought one, what is it, one swallow makes a spring, or whatever, if I thought, you know, it was a trend, I would be happy. And they asked, pretty obviously, the question is, holy cow, aren't there any minorities around here? None of the other graduate students that are, you know, in the previous years seem to be minority, none of the professors. By and large.
Does the history department do anything specifically to recruit minority students?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know what they've done about it.
I'd like to move to another topic now. And we could spend, I'm sure, 2 days talking about this topic alone. But let's just, and it's something that people can find out a little more on their own. So I'd like, we can just summarize this in 5 or 10 minutes. And that's your research interests. What research interests, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, did you bring with you when you came to UW? And briefly, how have these evolved to where you are now?
Uh-huh. Well, I came in the most conventional history of education arena, which was to figure out the origins of American public schooling in the 19th century. And that fit the concerns of the day. There was a lot of argument. There were these radical revisionists around saying that American public schools were and always had been racist and conformist and so forth. And my work lay in that middle ground that was a little bit of that and a little bit of a different story. So that was quite energizing. And I went along doing that. I learned to do quantitative history and applied to the same
Mars
field.
Mars Vanauskas, you did quantitative history.
Yes, I happened to be here, and the history department hired Maris Vanauskas.
Yeah. Excuse me.
Well, I'm sure it was Maris in Latvia, which is where he came from. He's actually born in Latvia, but he's Americanized it to Maris. So we did a big regression analysis and all kinds of computing, and I was on leave, you know, spending.
And that was back when that stuff was just really taking off.
Yeah.
It was not something that everybody did.
It was the rage in social history in the 70s. Maybe the granddaddy of it was this guy, Stephen Thernstrom at Harvard, who studied immigrants and social mobility. But he quickly got passed by people like Maris, who started applying complex statistical models and regression analysis and stuff. So I learned a lot of statistics, which I'd never known before, and I learned about computers. We did those with, I just threw a bunch of these things away. These were IBM cards.
Oh, the old IBM cards, yes.
80
Carl's
spaces on a field.
Carl's holding his hands about 10 inches apart and about, about 4 inches high or something.
Yeah, and a box of them is about as long as this table, and you would carry the box into the computer center. So we had about 10 or 15 boxes for this huge file in Massachusetts. So anyway, all of this was about the origins and social context and causes of the development of public schools. And I finally decided I should write a more synthetic book about that, which became this, whatever, third or fourth book in my life, which was called Pillars of the Republic. And I wrote that with a view towards saying, it's going to be confining in my life if I do this for the rest of my life. I've written enough books about some aspect of the origins of schools in England and America, mostly America. So having done this technical thing, which was very educational for me, the second book, which was on regression analysis, it sold. Gee, 600-700 copies, and it's a rarity now. It's not worth a lot of money, but it's very rare. You can't find it any place. And then I did Pillars of the Republic, and I thought this is enough. And I was looking around for something to do, not idly looking for something to do, but trying to make a strategy for a new subject, which is what academic researchers do. They try and keep one project ahead. Mm-hmm. I thought of doing something about the history of the federal role in elementary and secondary education, which would have been, mm-hmm. again, more conventional
I've
history
heard you
of education.
Talk about that on and off over the
And years. I wrote a little article on it with Mike Smith, who was by then the director of the research center here, and that was a lot of fun. I did a couple of conference papers on it. But I ultimately chose the history of literacy. Now, that sounds pretty closely related to the history of education, but the field was very exciting at the time. That's why I went into it. I got invited to some conferences as an outsider, as an educational historian. They said, come and
comment
be
on
a,
it?
Or yeah, they thought, they thought a conference on the history of literacy ought to have an educational history person around. So I got invited to one which was called the White House Conference on Literacy, and one that was called Library of Congress kind of Conference on the History of Literacy. So that was fun, and it was energizing, and I decided to go into that. Once I got into it, I realized it doesn't have very much to do with the history of schools. I mean, literacy is generally related to levels of schooling, but this was more about adult literacy and the uses of adult literacy and policies about literacy. And so that evolved into a project which went even further astray from the history of American education, which was called The Social History of the American Reading Public. That's a mouthful, but there's a bunch of subfields in U.S. social and cultural history that are moving toward each other and interrelating. None of them have very much to do with the history of education. One is the history of literacy. Can people read? How well can they read? And how do they use their literacy? Well, as soon as you ask the latter question, which is a fascinating question, you're into bumping up. So this project is the second major area of research that I've worked in, and I've been working in this second one. If the first one is the history of public schooling in 19th century America, this one, which is the history of literacy and the uses of literacy and the book in America, meaning text, published text, books, magazines, newspapers, this one I've been working on for about 10 years, since 1983 when I was on leave at Stanford. And it's produced one book, as you know, called Literacy in the U.S. that Yale published, and that was a lot of fun because, well, fun except for the fact that it was insanely ambitious and therefore it was kind of hard to know when you got done and it was hard to synthesize. But the first book in this line of research became a set of 9 research essays, and the fun thing was that I did it with graduate students, so I got a chance to collaborate with my paid assistants who have now gone off to do other things in academia.
Well, we're going to talk about collaboration in a minute, but did you feel as you went on in the study of literacy that you had a better, that your methodology improved? I mean, I remember you talking early on about just how difficult it was to sort out who's on first, because you're bumping into all these different periodicals and whatnot.
Yeah, that's why we wrote such a technical report. I seem to be good at that, you know, writing books that, as my mentor said, how nice that university presses like to publish research reports, and we intend them to be books, and they come between two hardcovers. But he's right. The first line, as in the book that I did with Mary Svanauskas, the first book in a set tends to be quite technical, and that's because social historians are interested in very hard questions that haven't been faced very much before about what the impact is on ordinary people of major transformations like industrialization and migration and so forth, and what is the way they spend their lives in terms of ordinary life course transitions. How do they, you know, go to school, and how does the social milieu they come out of affect that, and how do they get jobs and all that kind of stuff. So we ask very hard questions. And so I think also by temperament, I tend to be a careful person. And so I'm one of the people, if social historians can be described as being in two camps, just to oversimplify for a moment, one of the people that write stirring tales that have morals and are relatively straightforward and simple, and they tend to sell books beyond academia. That's the kind of books that makes public history. And then the more highly professionalized, methodologically self-conscious people are the people that say, well, you can't say that. You said you're talking about working class people and you're only talking about factory labor. What about the people in domestic service? What about this? What about that? Let's see what percentage of the population you're talking about. Well, it's superior methodologically and it makes for boring history. You know, it's not what the public wants to read. So my career has been, I think, a story of vacillating between those poles, and my natural temperament is more like on the cautious, self-conscious, methodological side, and one's ambition is always to speak to a larger audience. So once in a while I've succeeded, and I think the Pillars book actually got through that barrier and got out to a wider public, largely undergraduates who are told to buy it for a course. But and I've published a few articles in places like American Heritage, which probably has more subscribers than anything I've ever published in. You know, it goes on dentist office, waiting room tables and all that stuff. But when I try to do something for American Heritage, it's the typical kind of academic talks to the popular history people. They say, well, the anecdotes are really great, okay, so put some more of those in and not so much of this explanation stuff, you know? So
so as people are waiting for their root canals, they're reading about these anecdotes about the history of literacy.
Yeah.
One of the things that makes it for a great institution, and certainly one of UW's strong points, is its support of research through funding. Again, we could probably talk about this for a day, but let's limit it to just a little bit. What kind of research funding have you received over the years here at UW?
Well, I brought some money in from the outside, not big dollars. The university's probably supported me more than I've supported it. I've had fellowships as a kind of typical lone scholar kind of award that a lot of humanists get, and people who don't usually aren't involved in big programmatic research grants that provide dough to graduate assistants and all that kind of stuff. But just the year off kind of thing, I've had the usual round that a lot of academics have, a Guggenheim fellowship and a couple of research fellowships to go to centers on U.S. history, one at Harvard and one at Princeton, and then one, the Behavioral Sciences Center at Stanford. So those have all been things where I've just been bought off and had time to do research away from the campus. What we call extramural support in the other sense of bringing money in that helps support people, I had a couple of NIE grants that supported a few students' dissertations. I think three dissertations have been supported with outside money. I've had research grants for myself from the Spencer Foundation that have paid my keep in the research center here, which means that it helps pay secretaries and, you know, phones and all that kind of stuff. It's a real research grant, a programmatic research grant, and that has hired two graduate assistants pretty consistently over a period of 8 or 10 years. So that's been real outside money. I had NIE money, that's the old National Institute of Education, and that was real money. I've three times, taught NEH seminars, which brings a grant into the university and was a fun activity and is considered to be a grant that the university, I think, takes some pride in having. Lots of my colleagues have done that similar too. And I don't recall other things right now, but I'm ironically, I guess, I've been getting less grant money recently. When my last Spencer money finally came to an end, I was behind on the project. You can't go back to the well and get more water until you've made good on the last thing. And I've been very, very involved in some national activities, policy-oriented activities that don't produce scholarship and are not funded. And it's because of that reason that the Vilas professorship has been so valuable to me over the past 5 years.
Yeah, what exactly does the Vilas professorship provide you with?
When you are made a Vilas professor, at least when I was, I presume that the conditions are still roughly similar. It gives you a $10,000 raise in your salary, which has no effect on producing research. It just gives you a higher salary, which is nice. But it gives you a reduced teaching load, which is like a research grant in a way to a research-oriented professor. And that's what Vilas it said he intended. It was to have some professors have the time to do more research. Most importantly, in terms of this outside grant and having an assistant and so forth, it has tided me over at a time when I simply was not prepared to go get another outside grant because it gives you $15,000 a year research money. And that's the way I've maintained my position in the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, although there I've also been the beneficiary of some generosity on their part just because I've been around the place for so long and they overlooked the fact that I wasn't quite paying my keep the last few years. But I could partially do so. So the Vilas money has for me, always gone for part of a secretary, for a 1/3-time research assistant, which is a great help. I've had Dinah Stevens for the last several years, and she's been wonderful. I guess that's it. That's what Vilas does for you.
I should mention for anybody listening to this tape, Carl's mentioned a lot of different things he's been associated with. There is a resume of Carl's in his folder located in the Oral History Project office, so if you want to check up on that, please ask the oral historian for that. When you mentioned that I asked for two people to talk to about your career, and one of them was Jürgen. And the question, Jürgen Herbst, who retired from the department and currently lives in Durango, Colorado, And Jurgen said one thing he's always admired about you is your ability to collaborate with scholars and graduate students in your research. He said perhaps it's the German in him, but he just was never able to feel comfortable doing that. And he asked that I inquire about your ideas on collaborative research.
It was interesting he would say the Germans. I thought that the German ideal was scholars thinking together. the German seminar was supposed to be collaborative.
Well, this German.
Yeah. Well, despite my name, I'm French. I guess I said that in the introductory remarks. And I don't know if they collaborate in academia or not. In any case, I didn't plan it that way so much. The first collaboration I think I ever did was after I got my dissertation book out. Came back from years leave at Princeton, here was Maris Vanauskas, and at first I had planned a big project that I was going to go get funding for. I knew I was headed in that route because I knew by then I was a social historian and I knew I wanted to ask statistical questions and I wanted to ask questions on a fairly broad scale about urban-rural differences in education. There was Maris, who's a real imperialist about statistics. He just loves to grab hold of a colleague and say, any question you've got, we can ask it in a rigorous social science way, let me help you. And so I was, you know, all ears. And at first I had him written into the grant as a statistical consultant. I actually got the grant for me as solo author and him as a statistical consultant, which he agreed to, and he was busy with a lot of other things. And we struck it off so well, and we were having so much fun, although it was partly a tutorial relationship that he was teaching me about computers and stuff.
But, now, he was at Michigan at this time, right?
Well, he was here, and then I think he was here for 2 years when I was here, but... He may have been on the staff here for 3 years as an assistant professor, one of which he was in Cambridge, Massachusetts on leave, and 1 year I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts on leave. I think we were in Madison 1 year together, but we worked a lot together the year I was in Cambridge. He flew out there a lot. By then, we had lost him to the University of Michigan, where he's been ever since. That was a bad loss to the history department. But he was a very unconventional scholar, and I don't know if he had finished his dissertation. I guess he had finished it, but he hadn't published it, and he had already started other projects and all this stuff. So anyway, we just blew it. We should have kept him, and we didn't. We didn't try hard enough, and before we knew it, he was off to Michigan to a nice offer over there. So we collaborated together a lot on that book. It was a huge amount of work, and I think I found in social history, where you want to do statistics, it's really different. It really helps to have collaborators. I think I would find it difficult to collaborate, more difficult, more of a stretch for me to collaborate if the thing I was doing was really oriented toward articulating theory and doing kind of lonely humanistic research. And so I don't see that as easy a collaboration as the kind of social history I got involved in, which is just a natural for it. Mm-hmm. It's more fun to go to the computer center in twos, I gotta tell you, and try and pore over data and figure out what the heck it means. There's so many strategic decisions to be made along the way. So I did that with Maris, and after that it just got to be fun. I had the luxury of grants, and then when students would do things that were really first rate, and here we were at Wisconsin, you have first rate research assistants. I didn't do this early on. Maybe I wasn't organized well enough to use my research assistants properly, but eventually I got to using them for substantial projects, and then it just seemed to make sense to publish the things with them. And then we got a whole bunch of pieces together, and I think this makes a book. So I kind of knit all these people together into a collaboration. I've collaborated some with other people. Larry Stedman and I, a graduate student in sociology of education, did some pieces together. Well, they got worked into the literacy book. And then there was something else. Well, with Mike Smith about policy. So, I don't know, success breeds success in the sense that the relationships worked for me. I've had collaborations with people with quite different styles, where either I wrote better than they did and they were better methodologists than I was, or I'm fastidious about times and deadlines and communication and they were less so. But I've never, ever had a collaboration with somebody who didn't do their load, who didn't do their piece of the load. I think that's what turns some people off on collaboration. That would be problematic.
One bad experience might really...
Yeah. But whether it's in the future for me or not, I just haven't particularly planned.
So it's not something that you sought, it's just something that sort of...
No, and I have a wonderful collaborative thing going right now that just dropped in my lap. I mean, it was by invitation, and so I didn't design it at all. And that's to co-edit a volume in what is called A History of the Book in America. It's a five-volume work to be published by Cambridge Press, and I was invited to be the editor of the volume 4, which runs from 1880 to 1950.
And they just invited me to join their editorial board along with Janice Radway, who's a literary scholar from Duke and fabulous. I knew her work before. And when we realized they had invited us on the editorial board in order to make us co-editors of this volume, we gulped hard. We didn't know each other very well. And we thought, oh, I didn't know that's what this meant. And we've had a ball for the last couple of years. So that's been very exciting intellectually, I must say. Yeah. And that's because of the energy. Sometimes when people come out of different fields, they're relating to each other is nothing but a problem. But Jan and I were headed in a direction toward each other. Mm-hmm. She is a literary theorist who wants to do more historical work and yet feels that she doesn't know U.S. history entirely as well as people trained in and having worked 20 years in the field. And I'm a U.S. historian interested in becoming more theoretical about doing the history of the book. So we're having a lot of fun doing that.
Oh, that's great.
So that'll be the second effort in this new research world of mine about the history of the book. So I forgot. You know, I'm still collaborating.
There you go. You gave me another nice in a few moments ago when you mentioned Mike Smith. I'd like to change now to another tack. The R&D Center is now called the
Wisconsin Center for Education Research, WCER.
WCER. Okay, I'm writing that down because when I worked there, it was the R&D Center.
Right.
For Herb Klossmeyer and his group. When Mike Smith resigned as director, what year was that?
86.
You assumed the position of acting director, first for 1 year and then for another. First of all, how did you assume that? How did you end up assuming that role? How were you coerced into, as John Palmer might say, into staying for the second year? I did talk to John about this, and discuss your stay briefly as acting director and what you learned from mm-hmm. that.
I think I can do a thumbnail about how I got involved in the center in the first place to get you from R&D to WCER. When I came here as a faculty member in 70, the R&D Center was pretty new. The building was only a couple years old, and the institution had started in about 64 or 65. So at that point, it was a core grant. That is, all the people that worked there had money from a single grant from the government. It was one of 12 such university-based centers around the country. And it had a lot of successes in the Klossmeyer years, as you know, because mm-hmm. you were an assistant who worked on this, mm-hmm. Assessing this whole phenomenon of what it was called?
Individually guided education.
Yeah, IGE. In the years after that, when I came, that was, I think, petering out by 70. Not entirely, but largely. And so they were trying to figure out what to do with this core grant, and they had these several departments, you might call them, within the center. It had maybe something like $2 million a year, and so it probably had 20, 25 faculty associated with it and a bunch of graduate students. People outside of it at the Ed School considered it to be more or less a closed shop, that it was, a few people got in or out at certain times, but it was mostly educational psychology and mostly educational administration people that were in it. My department had never had anybody associated with it, I don't think, at all. Educational policy studies. Curriculum department didn't have very many, if any. And so it was a matter of pride to the school that they had it, but it wasn't as broad as it later became. And the feds were kind of beating up on them because the IGE stuff, at least was development that they could show, was, mm-hmm. boy, it was out there in the schools in a massive way. Most research doesn't get into schools that well. The R&D link doesn't work that well. So I really sympathize with the efforts made by those directors that came between Herb and Mike Smith, especially
Ross Miller,
whom I got to know a bit. I think he's a smart guy and tried his best, but the feds were a little unhappy here and there about what that place was going to become. When Klossmeyer decided he was going to be finished and the dean appointed a search committee to look for a director, Dean Palmer rightly saw that it ought to have insiders and outsiders on it, and so he asked me to be on it as an outsider. Hmm. So that's how I started. Hmm. That's how I got involved in the center.
You mean the search committee?
Yeah, I was on the search committee. I didn't chair it. I think Kurt Klebard chaired it. But I helped, in small ways, convince Mike to come here. I knew a lot about the Harvard environment, and I was, along with Mike Olnick, kind of a connection between Mike Smith incoming and the Department of Educational Policy Studies, of which he became a member, and so forth. So we kind of helped talk him into it. He was on his way out of the Carter administration, for those of your listeners who don't know about him, and he had been a professor of education at Harvard, but had been many years in Washington, very successful associate director of the research shop in Washington called the National Institute of Education. And then in the more generally in the Department of Education in a couple of different roles, Acting Commissioner of the Education of the United States, and then Chief of Staff to the first Secretary of Education, Shirley Hufstetler. So he was near the top of the administration of the whole department. So when Mr. Reagan was elected, that Carter years finished, and all those people were looking for jobs, and we beat out Northwestern happily. Northwestern wanted to offer him a big fat professorship and a fat salary and tell him to do nothing. And Mike, to his credit, didn't want to do nothing. He thought running a big complicated research center was a good thing to do. So he came here and he was here for 6 years. He warned us even before he came that he was for what was then called recompetition, which meant he didn't think there should be 12 centers with a presumption that they would go on forever, that they never had to think about winning a grant in competition with anybody else. And that was a policy that was gaining credence across political lines in the 80s. And so Mike came here, in a way, predisposed to end the very core grant that supported the center. And he told us that up front. We said, fine, we're for that too. Okay. Well, we figured we were so good we could compete for any grants that would be out there, and we'd probably just grow. And if the government started giving out grants for research in education on a topical basis, that it would be enriching to us to just do that. And that's what happened. The core grant ended. Recompetition took place in like 83, 84, 85. Mike is a wonderful leader in getting people to sit down and write big grant proposals to the government, the kind that are like for $1 million a year for 4 years and 5 years and so forth. And when the competition was all done in 85, I think, my dates may be off about a year or two on that, but when the competition was all done, the Wisconsin Center had garnered more research money than any other center, something like 10% of the money in the whole competition. We had Fred Newman Secondary Center. We had the National Center on the Study of Mathematics Education that Tom Romberg runs. And we had a piece of a policy center called the Consortium on Policy Research and Education, CPRE. All these acronyms now are still living over there. Mm-hmm. Fred's is a new center, and the Math Center has gone on and on and on and garnered money from elsewhere. So Mike decided in 1986 to leave for Stanford to become the dean. I think of some of these people like Mike Smith and like Donna Shalala as having careers that run in more or less six-year bunches. Sometimes it's four, sometimes it's seven, but I think the average is six.
And Mike was. Are they run out of town or do they pick up their bags?
Oh, no, Mike, we would have kept Mike if we could have. But he's energetic and ambitious and very talented, and he didn't apply for the deanship job at Stanford. They inveigled him into it. They begged him to come and act just as a consultant, just as a consultant. So then when he came there, you know, they had all their star professors out there to beg him to be dean. So he decided it was time for him to do that. He'd won a lot of this competition. I don't think it was quite as clear what the challenge would be at Wisconsin. For whatever reasons, he moved on. He decided in May, which is a heck of a time in academia to decide these things, because it's sort of too late for a major position to start a search committee. So there was obviously going to be an acting. I was friends with him. I don't really recall why they settled on me, but other than that, Palmer had liked the job I'd done as chair of EPS. I guess he knew I was careful. I wouldn't wind up in jail and so forth. So Smith, I honestly don't remember how the first conversation got started, but I was friends with Mike Smith and talked to him a lot about his decision to go to Stanford. And so they were asking me whether I might be interested in being acting and or making myself available for a real search, a competitive search, to be the director of the center. And I thought about it a lot. I have had a flirtation with administration for a long time, as you know. Was not particularly happy being chair of a department. I think that's a tough row to hoe. But the center, it seems to me, was way bigger. It's like 10 times as big as Educational Policy Studies in terms of employees and money and so forth. And it's so well managed and has so many veteran administrators that I thought, here's my chance to, first of all, I love the place. Secondly, I know it's a no-lose situation, pretty much, because it's so well run. Now, that doesn't mean it was all set up for me and it just purred along. I had a big decision to make about reorganizing the business office right away. It was a decision I sort of wish that Mike had done before he left, but he had about seven people in the business office reporting directly to him, and we needed to have a business manager who was the personnel, who was the
supervisor of the other people. And so there was a lot of restructuring that went on. In any case, I said yes, I would be interested in being the acting person for a year, and that the main job of that year would be to run a national search and find a new first-grade director like Mike, and I was not like Mike. The big difference was I'd never worked in Washington, and he had worked a long time in Washington, and that helped him immensely because he knew not only the people and the grants process and so forth, but he knew from long, long experience what a good major grant looked like. And I don't mean in trivial terms and kind of like pushing the right buttons, but in substantive terms, he knew how to do it. So he was great at going into a room and telling people from different disciplines, look, yeah, this is really wonderful what you people have done up until now. And I know you've worked hard, but here's seven things that are wrong with this, and you got to go home and work all weekend on it again because it's due Monday morning. And here's what you need to make this seem like a real team project. It's interdisciplinary and not just a bunch of individuals doing their own work. That's the way I characterize what Mike could do. I've watched him do it. I've watched him succeed at doing it. It's what his successor, or my successor, Andy Porter, can also do. And I could have learned to do it a little better, but I was starting from scratch. So, I mean, I had a chance in those 2 years to do it in a few cases. No great successes, but we came in second in a fine arts one that I worked hard on with the music and art people at the university. So it's a skill that one can work on, but it really helps to have been in Washington, and Andy and Mike had both done that. So I said I'd do the acting thing. We settled on Andy in our search, Andy Porter from Michigan State University, and lo and behold, he was the person we really wanted to do this. He looked interested, but he had a son who was about to graduate from high school the next year. So he said, I won't come this year, but I'll come next year. So basically, the year had gone well enough. It had not given me an ulcer. I was trying at that time to be the house person in my household that was around when my kids came home from high school, because my then wife had a really busy professional job and really couldn't get home till 5:30, 6 sometimes later. So I made a rule, even though I was moving into this directorship, that I would be out of the office most of the time at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it worked. The staff is so good. I worked a lot of hours to make up for that. Yeah. I worked a lot of evenings and a lot of weekends, but it was doable. And the quotient of really unpleasant, really wrenching things to do compared to just an awful lot of things to do with really first-rate, cheerful, professional staff, the ratio was not bad. There were a few nasty things to be taken care of, but the dean was so terrific. The dean was a wonderful person to work with.
Dean Palmer.
Yeah. And the five or six people that worked for me, including Jerry Grossman, who became the business manager, Lois Opaleski, who's the executive secretary of the whole place, are so good that it was a good experience. And I did find that I liked administration. There's a certain sense, I don't know if this is the way David Ward would describe it. I once heard him asked by Gerda Lerner at a party, well, what would a smart academic like you ever want to be doing being a dean, as if, you know, like that was like cleaning out dog cages or something. And David explained to her his satisfaction in it, which is there is a certain satisfaction you get, and you have to want to do this to be a dean of a graduate school or something. You have to really get a kick out of facilitating other people's work in a pretty major way, and you can do a lot of it. You can do a lot of people from a deanship, and you're not within your own bailiwick with your own agenda, but you can do so much if you have success at it to facilitate a whole lot of other people's work. I wasn't thinking of that so much at the research center. I was thinking of the psychological pace of working with a lot of really good administrators, let's say bureaucrats. I even like that word when the people are good. And somebody says, okay, you didn't want to do this, but you have to reclassify all of your academic staff. It's going to take 2 weeks. Here's the rules. They're imperfect. A lot of people are going to be unhappy. Go to it. You know, and it's due in 2 weeks. And there's no exceptions about this. This is not like academic life. And if you're working in a really good place and you're working with good-willed people who are talented, and the results of that thing are going to be consequential to someone, it's going to matter how they get reclassified. When the 2 weeks from Friday comes and you've done the best job you can and you turn the thing in, there's a certain satisfaction in that. That is unlike scholarship, and it is, I think, more pretty much unlike teaching at a university. There's just kind of a teamwork effort to get these administrative things done.
If I could interrupt for a second, when I did talk to John Palmer, he like Jürgen, had one special question he wanted me to ask you, and he said simply that had you chosen, you could have been a successful administrator here at the university. And he intimated that you would have been a prime candidate, for example, to replace John when he did retire as dean of the School of Education, but that you had let it be known that you weren't terribly interested in doing that. Why haven't you? You just gave a positive reason about how.
Yeah, I know. Any jerk that could say it was fun to reclassify their academic staff, you know, you ought to be an administrator.
The example is, I just couldn't let that pass by. Why have you? And I don't think it's any real secret that you could have pursued a very successful. As a matter of fact, I think John told me that he learned only after the fact that you had been approached to be an associate dean of the graduate school the second year, but you had already made a commitment to him to be. Director for another year. So you certainly had the opportunities, had you elected to take them. Why didn't you?
Well, I like doing this. It's been an ambivalence. It hasn't been very fair to my friends because I never could make up my mind. I actually like both, but I did it in a way by refusing to ever make the real plunge and go into a long-term administrative job that would bring you irrevocably away from teaching. And especially away from advising graduate students. By not doing that, I could have my cake and eat it too. By being the director of the center for 2 years, I got a chance to do a bigger job than a department chair, but I knew it was limited and I was going to get finished with it. I really didn't want to be long-term director because I didn't think I was the right kind of skills for that. I loved the graduate school through the window I saw it from, because that was being on the research committee of the graduate school. And that's why I even mentioned the other day at my farewell party, getting to know David Ward through that committee. Now, associate deans of the graduate school do a whole lot of other stuff that isn't quite so much fun. But in any case, doing that would have been a major step toward having a more academic administrative career. A lot of people go from those associate deanships to some other thing. Bernie Cohen did that. Crawford Young, kind of came up into administrative ranks and then finally wound up in the faculty in the end. I always got cold feet when I thought I wouldn't have graduate students anymore, which has been a big part of my academic life and a hugely rewarding one.